Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this New Books Network podcast on public policy. My name is Leo Nascar, and today I'm joined by Dr. John Lapidus. John is currently a research fellow at the School of Business, Economics and Law within the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, where he earned his PhD in 2015. Prior to John's academic career, he spent several years as a journalist and also spent time working in Nicaragua with the Swedish-Nicaragua Friendship Association, an international NGO that helps communities build self-help organizations and tackle poverty. But today we're discussing his book, The Quest for a Divided Welfare State. Published in 2019, it documents the challenge to the universal welfare system in Sweden and its replacement by a multi-tier exclusionary paradigm. It excellently identifies the methods through which neoliberal advocates promote private provision of welfare and private funding, and explains how these features interact in a self-reinforcing way to nullify opponents and win over ambivalent actors in the political sphere. And though focused on the Swedish welfare state and political economy, we'll also draw out general lessons that apply to developed democracies the world over, tracing the divided welfare state back to the proliferation of neoliberal ideas, which have challenged the model of welfare provision in essentially every European country, and indeed much more broadly. John, it's a pleasure to be talking to you today. I wanted to start by asking you about the title. What made you call the book The Quest for the Divided Welfare State? It's very interesting to me because it's interesting that you emphasize the agency of those actors pursuing that division. So please tell us, if you will, a little bit more about the title and how everything has led to you writing the book.
Thank you so much, Leo, and thank you very much for the invitation, of course. I'm happy to be here. It is quite obvious for most people that we are moving away from what we call the Swedish welfare model. We actually called it a lot of different things. We call it the Swedish welfare model, the Scandinavian welfare model, the Nordic welfare model, since it was quite similar in many countries, not only Sweden, but also Denmark and Norway and so on. We called it the universal welfare model to say that it was inclusive and for everyone. In the most famous categorization of all by the sociologist Esping Anderson, he called it the social democratic welfare model, and he contrasted it to the conservative and to the liberal welfare model. But we can also talk about the liberal welfare model, but we can also talk about the divided welfare model or the divided welfare state, which I think is quite an accurate term for describing what is happening, because a divided welfare state is actually when we get two different welfare states in one and the same country. We get one hidden welfare state. It has been termed by Howard, for instance, in 1999, the hidden welfare state. That is the part of the welfare state that is for the more affluent groups of society. And then we get a visible, more public welfare state for those who remain in the public system. And the most extreme example that we see in the world today maybe is the United States, of course, where you have this typical division between a hidden and a visible welfare state. because in the United States, for instance, for healthcare, which that's my main interest, and I try to draw on the example on the rapid rise of private health insurance in Sweden to show that we are moving towards this kind of divided welfare state. But in the United States, if you can prove yourself poor enough, you can get treatment by Medicaid, it's called. And if you prove yourself old enough, you are entitled to Medicare for old people. So that's the visible part of the welfare state. But in such a divided welfare state, that is also what you mean by welfare. So you actually say to people that he is on welfare. If he or she is on Medicaid, he's on welfare. So you get a total different connotation of the word welfare. It's not meant for everyone. It's only for some stigmatized groups, which are needs based on needs, based on poverty or based on age. They are entitled to a second class type of visible welfare, and that is also the. In the public debate, you only debate that kind of visible welfare, because that's the only type of welfare that you can actually see. You can see it in all the budgets and so on. It's very visible. But on the other hand, you have the hidden welfare state, which also costs the state a lot of money. And that's the secret behind the hidden welfare state, that it's also very costly for the state, not because of direct spending where you take in taxes and then you spend like on Medicaid and Medicare, but it's more about an indirect spending where the state loses tax revenue due to a lot of tax breaks. For example, the huge tax breaks in the United States, both for individuals and for employers when it comes to private health insurance. So due to that, the state loses enormous amounts of money each year. And if you put this hidden welfare state on top of the visible welfare state in the United States, then you see that we all often think that the welfare state in the United States is quite small, but that's because we only look at the visible part of it. If we add the hidden part, then we see that it almost comes up to European levels.
And I think there are two real sort of key aspects here. There's the way in which welfare is funded, whether it's private or public. There's also the provision, and whether that is provided by the state through sort of county councils and state-run hospitals or privately. And I think that's really where the story starts, in that in the liberal divided system in the US, it's very private. And by contrast, in so the 60s, 70s in Sweden, it was not so at all. But our story really starts with, as Sweden becomes more privatized in terms of provision. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about how that comes about, but more on what's the effect of that on the welfare landscape and the welfare mix and that political economy.
Yeah, exactly. I think the privatization of provision in Sweden, which started already in the early 1990s or even the late 80s, that is actually the key to the privatization of funding, which is one example is, of course, the private health insurance, which has risen quite rapidly in Sweden. We now have about 700,000 individuals who sign up for private health insurance. That's about that's more than 10% of the grown-up population. So I find this mutual independence or mutual dependence between provision and funding of welfare. So what do I mean by that? I mean that if the insurance companies in Sweden, the private funding side of the thing, if they will be able to send their 700,000 customers somewhere, they need to look for privately provided healthcare units, hospitals, primary care clinics, and so on. So, because still in Sweden we have a lot of healthcare that is publicly provided, and you cannot go to a publicly provided healthcare center with your private health insurance claiming that you shall have fast access, because that's the idea behind the Swedish private health insurance, that you get very fast access to clinics. You cannot go to publicly provided healthcare units to do that. So in order to be able to use your private health insurance, you are dependent on privately provided healthcare all over the countries. All over the country and also on all care levels. So if it hadn't been that we first privatized the provision of healthcare, then we wouldn't have seen this rapid rise of privatization of the funding. So that's how they are interlinked. And so private funding is totally dependent on a net of private providers, but the private providers also becomes more and more dependent on private funding. That's because most of the privately provided health units in Sweden, they are for profit and they need to spread their risks. And it can be quite risky to have an agreement only with the county council. So they seek profits not only from the public side but also from the private side. That's one aspect of it. Another aspect is that they are actually getting more money from the insurance companies than they do from the county councils. So they earn more money on their private health insurance customers than they do on the rest of the people who comes as ordinary patients. And that's a quite critical factor, because that can mean that in the long run, the private providers might be more interested in the insurance companies and less interested in the public sector, in the county councils. We see that, for instance, in the United States, that, as I said before, you are entitled to some kind of second-class healthcare if you are old enough or poor enough. But in many states in the United States, you have nowhere to go because the private providers won't take you. They won't see you because they know they don't get as much money from Medicaid or Medicare as they do from the insurance companies. So that's a risk in the long run. We don't see that at all in Sweden yet, because it's still the case that the private providers, almost all of them, are more dependent on the public sector than on the insurance companies. But this might also be some kind of qualitative change in the long run.
I think to add to that point, it's really interesting how in the US, private insurers are paying providers up to 50% more compared to what the state is able to pay. So we see that once private funding is let into the welfare mix, it can really spiral, working alongside private provision to create a really dominant aspect of the welfare mix. And at the same time, I think whilst private provision sort of unlocks the door to this dominant feature, this divided welfare state, it needs something to push it before private funding can be unlocked. What's sort of the smoking gun? And I think one of the ideas is that the smoking gun that creates this big mix is the state. And first, the state has a big role in getting private provision kickstarted and making it such a dominant player in the provision of welfare. But second, it also has that big role that you referenced with tax breaks, etc., to support private funding. Because again, without the state, you would have neither the private provision nor the private funding. And I wondered if you could talk about the state's role in both of those areas.
Yeah, it's very true that, for instance, the rise of private health insurance in Sweden was very much due to legal stuff, which is often under the radar for the public debate. For instance, the tax breaks thing, because that's also a part of why we call it the hidden welfare state. It's outside the public debate. It's about very complicated tax measures and tax decisions. And it's also a lot of business secrecies in it, because as a researcher, as a journalist, as a public, you cannot easily get access to all the statistics because it's private actors who have access to it, and they are not very happy to leave it out to anyone. So, for instance, in Sweden, it was possible to make a very generous tax break on private health insurance. You could actually, if we take a very simple example, if you earn 30,000 crowns a month, in Sweden we talk about crowns, Swedish crowns, then you pay 50% tax, you get 15,000 in your wallet, and then you buy a private health insurance for 5,000. Then of course you get 10,000, and that's without the state subsidy of the whole thing. But the way it happened in Sweden was that you still earn 30,000 a month. Your employer buys the private health insurance for you for 5,000, and then of course before tax you have 25,000, and then you pay 50% tax, and then you get in the wallet 12,500, and that's the magic behind it. That's the trick that the state have suddenly. You have earned as an individual, you have earned 2,500 crowns, but who lost that money? Of course, it's the state who loses that money, and this is how it works with the tax break. And there was a political debate in Sweden a few years ago where the Social Democrats and the Left Party tried to abolish these generous tax breaks, because if you get something from your employer, the normal thing in Sweden is that you pay tax for it, but this was an exemption. So they tried to abolish this this generous tax break, and they managed to create a law saying that from now on you cannot do this kind of tax break. But then, interestingly enough, the what we now choose to call it, but the welfare industrial complex, or the big or even more every year more powerful welfare industry in Sweden, they were, of course, not very happy with this law, so they went to the tax agency in Sweden and complained, and they demanded that the law should be interpreted in another way. So they managed to make the tax agency create a new announcement, a new interpretation of this law, where only 50% is included in the law, and 50% is still possible to make this kind of tax break. So that's an example of how, when we, I mean, the Swedish welfare model was, the main characteristic of the Swedish welfare model was that we had a public monopoly almost on both provision and funding of welfare, like healthcare, elderly care, education, and so on. But when you start to privatize first the provision and then also the funding, then you, of course, you get a lot of very strong actors in society who are joining all kind of state inquiries and so on. And this is an example where they even have the power to influence authorities in Sweden, like the tax agency, which you think is very hard to influence in that way, especially when there is a law which is very clear on the subject. But this shows that these kind of actors have today, they have a lot of power. And when we are making the welfare into a market, I mean, Sweden was characterized by a mixed economy where we actually had taken away some parts of society from the logics of the market. We had put it aside. We put elderly care, healthcare, and education aside from the market, from the logic of the market. But now when we once again make it into a market economy, then of course we also get all these actors which also try to privatize more, both on the funding side and on the provision side.
And I think, let's introduce these actors now. At least some of the big companies that you referenced in the book, Capio in healthcare, Attendo in sort of social care, and Academedia in education. These are some of the big players that you reference. And I think before we get into now that they're big players, what are they doing? I'd like to talk about sort of when they were small players. What's their, what are their origins? Because the state has a big role in this as well.
Yeah, that's true. And that's quite ironic, actually, because some of these big companies were actually created from the so-called wage earner funds, which was a socialist feature or experiment where you were supposed to take some of the profits from big companies and hand it out to the unions. Something was which was, of course, very disputed and which was a signal of the big break, actually, for the Swedish welfare model, where the employers revolted against the Swedish welfare model because they of course, didn't like this kind of socialist thinking where you were going to take some of the profits and even more and more profits every year. So ironically, some of these big companies were actually created from these wage earner funds in the beginning. And it was also said in the beginning that many of these actors were to remain very small. They were supposed to be cooperatives and non-profit organizations, foundations, and so on. But soon enough, they grow to very big actors. And you mentioned, for example, Capio in the healthcare sector. They became a very big actor with many hospitals, with maybe 100 or 120 primary care clinics all over the country. And it was recently actually sold to an Australian company called Ramsay, which is in turn, it's a French company, which in turn is controlled by Australian capital. So we have actually sold a lot of Swedish healthcare to Australia in these days. So that's also an example where we lose not only the public control, but also some kind of national control of healthcare. And it's turned into a global capital sector.
And then we have these big organizations that perhaps don't have an understanding of the Nordic or Swedish model and are going about things their own way. When they're this influential, what are the ways in which they then influence the public debate about the divided welfare state?
Sorry?
What are the ways in which they then go about influencing the debate? Now they're influential, they have this huge sort of heft in the welfare sector. They have a large number of employers who are now reliant on them. And of course, now that you have private provision, you have people getting their welfare not from the state, but from their own employer in whatever sector they are as well. And I think these things are all really, really significant for the future developments that we see.
Yeah, exactly. And there are also, it must be said also that there are, in this kind of development, there are all the time more and more actors who are drawn into it, be it on their own will or not, but there are new facts on the ground. And for example, one very important actor is the unions, both the white collar and the blue collar. We have the academic unions in Sweden within TCO and SACO, and we have the blue collar within LO. And the white collar unions are actually offering their members now private health insurance. The blue collar unions are still very skeptical to this. And I think that is one of the game changers when the unions start to offer this kind of new welfare instruments to their members. And if we once again look at the United States, we see that there was actually a window for a more European or Swedish even healthcare system already in the 1930s or 1940s. We had presidents like Truman and Roosevelt who were quite radical in this aspect. They wanted some kind of Medicare for all. But already then, the unions had signed up agreements with the employers, with the insurance companies, so they were not interested. They are already refrained from wage increases because of these kind of agreements. And this is some kind of, they are still locked into this system in the United States. And we saw in the run-up for the Democratic election where Bernie Sanders tried to talk to the union saying, I want Medicare for all, I want a Scandinavian healthcare system. And he was actually booed out by some of the unions while Biden traveled around warning for Bernie Sanders' crazy ideas about healthcare on equal terms and so on. So we see that that's an aspect which is very important when the unions, who have hundreds of thousands of members, of course, when they start to provide their members with this kind of divided welfare state, welfare tools and privileges, then things start to happen very fast.
And I think it's really interesting how often in this story of the development, we've seen how institutions that are sort of meant to be, in quote marks, defending labor interests with wage earner funds and unions, how they sort of become much more prosperous, and they end up sort of switching sides again, in quote marks, which you can't put in an audio recording, but I'm doing it. And you have sort of a wage earner fund that's used to develop a company that goes on to become a major private provider. You have unions who, as their members and as their society becomes wealthier, start to opt for private insurance. Again, they align themselves more in that neoliberal direction. Do you think it's inevitable that as people become wealthier, they perhaps become more individualistic and less community minded, or is this just the way that the debate has gone in recent decades, but not how it need go in the future?
I think the main explanation for all of this is the rifts we see between people. I mean, up until the 1980s, Sweden was actually becoming more equal and was one of the most equal countries in the capitalist world, at least. So, but since the mid-1980s, we have seen a lot of division in terms of income, and we have seen a lot of political measures where we have abolished many taxes for the rich, for example, a number of taxes, and we have seen the tax ratio sinking a lot during the last year. So I think actually that it is very difficult to even have a Swedish welfare model when the Gini coefficient is changing so much as it has done in Sweden. I think it's very difficult to have a society where you are supposed to, where every class in society is supposed to be content with the welfare services provided by the public, when there are so big differences between the classes. I think you have to push the wage structure together much more in order to be able to create a Swedish welfare model, actually. So I find it very difficult to do that when we at the same time are abolishing all taxes for the rich and so on. Mm-hmm. So it all sticks together somehow.
And so in that sense, there is at least an element of path dependency here, whereby you get, as we talked about with the spiral before, as you get onto it a little bit, it becomes more of a powerful phenomena. And I think there are other sort of aspects of this that are worth exploring. For example, when we talk about a divided welfare state, we're also talking about the psychological factor that's, and the way people think about welfare. We're thinking about whether people trust state systems, and we're also thinking about how willing people are to pay for private systems when they already have, how willing people are to pay their tax for public systems when they already have private welfare. How do you see these sort of dimensions developing in Sweden? What's been the trend?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of eroding effects in this new parallel system, which is coming forward more and more. For example, in the healthcare sector with the rapid rise of private health insurance. Of course, many people feel that now I have arranged my own welfare. I have paid for it by my own, even though it's heavily state subsidized in many ways. People don't think about that. They think that I have paid for my own healthcare now, so why should I then also pay for a public healthcare which I no longer use? So that's of course a risk of a reduced tax willingness in the future or even right now, and we see that the tax ratio is actually sinking every year. So it's of course very difficult to put all this into some kind of regression analysis and get a paper on what's affecting what and so on. It's obvious that it's a threat against the willingness to pay taxes when you create a parallel system. It also has a lot of opinion making very, very important aspects of it. Now when we have 10% of the population in this parallel healthcare system, it's mainly the most vocal groups in society, and they do no longer see the problems in the public healthcare sector. We have a lot of problems, but they don't see them, and they don't have any self-interest anymore in finding solutions. So they do not put pressure on politicians to solve the problems in the public sector. And when the most vocal groups no longer put pressure on politicians, then politicians can continue to cut down more easily than if those groups would have been there putting pressure on them. So it's also a matter of what we call blame avoidance, that the politicians don't get any blame from these vocal groups because the politicians let them out to another system where they can enjoy themselves.
And I think it's worth bringing in ideas about what incentives the politician faces in this sense, because if you're a politician and your health system isn't working, for example, it's much easier to say that the system is broken rather than I'm broken. It's much easier to say that this is just an impossible thing to run and we should privatize it, compared to saying I can do it, but you don't want to sort of raise the possibility that another politician can do better. You'd much rather say this whole thing is impossible. And I think that segues us really nicely into the debate and the rhetoric around this debate and the dichotomy there between rhetoric and reality. Because I think once you start having these incentives as a politician, the debate becomes very fractured and it becomes very detached from reality. And that's something that you document quite a lot in the book. I wondered if you could talk through some of the examples there and how the welfare debate has become twisted in a sense.
Yeah, there are a lot of things to say about that. One of the things is that we have a very influential Social Democratic Party in Sweden, not maybe as influential as it used to be, but still. And within that party, you see a lot of discrepancy between rhetoric and practice in these kind of issues, because some parts of the sayings from the party are directed to the grassroots, to critics, to people who want to go back to the Swedish welfare model, and some other parts of it are actually directed to the welfare industry, and you never know exactly what is going on. One very concrete example was we actually had a stop law in Sweden for a while
This was in 2006, right?
Yeah, exactly. Private providers had to choose between insurance companies and the county councils. They could not have agreements with both sides, so to say. So they had to choose one side, and that would have put a quite big hindrance on the rapid rise of private health insurance. But then if you read the bill, it starts by saying that now we are creating this stop law. But then in the bill itself, which is about 30 pages, you see a lot of loopholes and a lot of exemptions and so on. And finally, it's even said that private providers should not be very worried about this law because it doesn't have any effect in reality. So it's a very crazy document, actually. And then with that document, the Social Democrats could say to their own grassroots and to critics and so on, now we are creating this law, which will stop the VIP lanes, the fast access to health clinics and so on. But on the other hand, they could say to the private providers that this law doesn't mean much, so you can just keep on growing and keep on growing this industry. So we have these mixed messages from many parts of societies, also from the unions who continue to say that we are very keen on having a Swedish welfare model, a universal welfare state. But on the other hand, they are in practice, they are offering their members these kind of welfare solutions within the hidden welfare state. So there is a lot to say about these differences between rhetoric and practice from many actors.
Mm-hmm. Because on the same side, in 2007, I believe, you have the START law introduced by the new centre-right government, which sort of goes through exactly the same things.
Yeah, exactly. The centre-right wing political parties, they were not very happy with this stop law. So as soon as they got into power in 2007, they abolished the stop law, and then they continued with what they called the START law, which was actually the same thing that applied before the stop law. So then the insurance companies and so on were again free to sign agreements with private providers who already had agreements with the county councils, and that we have seen ever since, and because of that this parallel system has been growing and growing.
And then all while sort of they were pushing through this law, at the same time the centre-right government is saying that they're nonetheless opposed to two separate queues, and it's this dichotomy between rhetoric and reality, which I think you don't have to be in Sweden to relate to that. It's particularly common in sort of where I'm speaking from in the UK. It's something that's very much relatable with respect to Tony Blair's new Labour government. It's something that you can relate to all across the world, that dichotomy.
You could actually call it a kind of newspeak, a neoliberal newspeak, where two queues are not two queues, where inequality is not inequality and so on. So it's a very strange wall of discourse that you have to break through before you can even start to discuss the questions. And of course, the private welfare industry, they want to confuse the debate as much as possible, because they cannot go out in Sweden and say that we want to have an unequal system. We want healthcare to be viable, or to be you can buy a car, why shouldn't you buy healthcare and so on. So they cannot be that frank, so they have to come up with arguments also to create exactly, to their 700,000 customers who signed up for private health insurance, because they feel they feel sometimes questioned, of course, in the debate and so on. Should I really, why am I supposed to have quick access to healthcare? And they search for arguments and then they are provided with arguments to make them feel better so the private welfare industry even say that they are doing a good thing for the universal welfare model. They are easing the universal welfare model. So that's a very strange argument, because we are actually, when you create a parallel healthcare system in Sweden, you are actually destroying the common, the universal welfare system, by creating two different systems. So that can never be good for the common system that you tear it apart.
Mm-hmm. This reference to how organizations are trying to depoliticize the issue really reminds me of an excellent book by Pepper Culpepper at Oxford called Quiet Politics, which is about how businesses in France, Germany, all across the world, but he uses examples in France, Germany, Japan, and the Netherlands, about how they try to depoliticize issues, push them off the agenda, and then all of a sudden they can lobby behind the scenes to achieve their own agendas, which aren't necessarily aligned with the interests of people more broadly. But I don't want to end and approach the end on a sort of a negative light, because at the same time, we've talked about laws and developments in the welfare system that lead to division and inequality, and we've talked about how it's path dependent, but it's not necessarily like this. One of the chapters in the book talks about the education sector and how homework assistance or tutoring, which is enormously common throughout Europe, in the UK, for example, about 20% of people are on private tutoring in addition to their to supplement their public education. And in Sweden, I believe there was a law to sort of to subsidize this. But tell us a bit more about that, and then how sort of the left groups managed to remove it and introduce a more equal approach to education.
Yeah, it's true that we had some kind of tax break also in the education system, where you could make a tax break for homework assistance. The parents could do that for their children, and that's of course a very unequal instrument, because even though it's heavily state subsidized, it is still quite expensive to do it. But you get half the cost paid by the state, but you have to pay half the cost yourself. So all people cannot do it, and so it's exclusive both on a formal side, because you have to have a tax to deduct. If you don't have that tax, you can't make the deduction, you can't make the tax break. So many people are formally excluded. But then there is a much bigger group which is excluded in reality, because they can't afford it, even though they have some tax to withdraw. It's still too expensive to do it. So it's a very unequal instrument, which is very much a feature of the hidden welfare state, and directed towards the more affluent groups of society. So since it is in the school sector, which is maybe the most sensitive sector, it was possible to create opinion against this kind of tax break, because it was quite obvious to big groups that it had this unequal mechanism built into it. So therefore, the Social Democrats and the Left Party and so on, they created a lot of fuss against this, and they were able to abolish this kind of tax break in 2015, I think it was. So that's one of the examples that things can be done to prevent the rise of this kind of hidden welfare state. It is possible, yeah.
And I think that's a very important and positive and optimistic note to end on. So thank you very much for talking to me today, John. Thank you everyone for listening to this episode. As well, if you'd like to contribute to the discussion, build on the ideas that we've talked about today, you can head over to leonascal.com, and you'll find a section on the homepage about John's book and what we can learn from it. And you'll also be able to offer your thoughts as well. In addition, I'd love to hear your feedback. Let me know what you thought about this podcast anonymously at bit.ly/feedback-leo, both with a capital F and L. Both links will be in the description below. Love to hear from you. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you all enjoyed the podcast and are able to bring John's book up soon in discussion with a friend or a colleague or with family. But for now, hope you enjoy the rest of your day.